And welcome to this 12th episode of our podcast, Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas, and I'm just back from the wilds of Europe. And my co-host is David Grigg. Hello, David.
Hi, how are you, Perry? Are you lucky so-and-so traveling over the overseas like that? But never mind, it's good. I'm glad you had a good time over there.
I did. Thank you very much. Yep. Very tiring. Wore me out completely.
I'm sure. What was the best bit?
Hiking on an Icelandic glacier, I think, probably might be the bit that is going to stick in my mind for a while. It was quite out there. It was a really bit difficult. We didn't do a huge amount, but, novices that we are, and we didn't really want anybody sliding down into crevices and being able to get out again, because the guide did tell us, if you drop your phone, let it go. If you chase after it and you end up in a crevice, we're probably going to have to leave you there. Yeah. And you sit there and you think, oh, yeah. And then you start thinking, hang on. I don't like the sound of that terribly much. Mm-hmm. But basically, you can understand what they're getting at. It's just too hard to get you out. Or you may be lucky, but if you end up going into a crevice and getting into some deep, cold, icy cold water, you're probably going to get hypothermia very quickly and you're going to go unconscious and they won't be able to get you out in time. Mm. So that being said, they did say that, just be careful, don't move too quickly. And nobody fell and everybody had a good time. So it was good. It was excellent. But I also have to thank you for doing a sterling job while I was away and holding the fort. That's right. And also want to give a shout out to our good friend Kerry Henfield.
Yes.
Saw him last night and said that I'd give him a shout to thank him very much for stepping into the breach. It was good. I'm glad it all worked well, and it all ticked along very nicely from what I can gather.
Yeah, it was fine. It was really because we had so much material that we'd already got in the can. You know, the interviews that you and I had done to have those to hand was great. So it was really a matter of just picking and choosing among that sort of stuff to put it together. So I think it worked pretty well. And we've covered a fair bit of Fennish history, which is good.
It's all about planning, David. It's all about planning, which is what we'll get to later on when we're discussing some books this afternoon. But anyway, I know that one of the first things that you wanted to talk to me about was this Dublin Worldcon that I went to.
Sure.
So giving you a bit of an overview about what it was like, I have to let you know that I really don't attend Worldcons for a lot of the same reasons that other people go there for. A lot of people go to listen to the authors and editors talking to on the panels. They go along to the cafe clatches and literary beers. And if you're not sure what a cafe clatch is, it's where you sign up for 8 or 10 people sign up to sit around and have a cup of coffee with a particular author and ask them any questions they particularly like to ask. And so you get about an hour of an intimate conversation with the author of your choice. There's just about all of them, all the authors that attend the Worldcon go and do these. Some of them do it with coffee, some do it with beer, whatever they feel like it. But it's just a means of allowing the fans to get up close and personal. Well, not too close and not too personal with an author, but gives you the opportunity to sit and have a chat to them. I don't normally do that. My major reason for going along to Worldcons is to catch up with all the people that I've met over the years to do the sort of more fanny style stuff and to see what's going on with that. However, even if you are doing it from that point of view and just using it as a sort of a large social event rather than a intense literary discovery, you can still have some ideas about what the convention's going like. Now, Worldcons, as you'll be aware, David, but maybe not everybody else does, really only have to do 3 or 4 things. Firstly, they have to hold the business meetings for the World Science Fiction Society. Every Worldcon is held under the auspices of the World Science Fiction Society, which is a non-profit incorporated organisation of fans from all around the world who basically want to make sure that the Worldcons are run properly and that any topics that need to be discussed that are going to impact the Worldcons are all discussed in a formal debating mechanism where everybody knows what the rules is and everybody gets an opportunity to have their say so that nobody can overly dominate. It all is pretty dry, but it's absolutely essential to ensure that the Worldcons run properly. They're now no longer a small little convention of 100 or 200 people. This year there were 5,800 there. London had over 10,000. We're talking a massive amount of money that is flowing through the coffers of the Worldcon committee. I know that we in Melbourne in 2010 turned over $1 million. That is, you know, $500,000 coming in, half going out. So the accountants always like to double things just to make it look good. But who knows what London turned over. It would have been vastly more than that. So you have to make sure that everything is above board. Everything looks like it fits properly with the authorities because you don't want them coming down on top of you for them thinking that you're running a commercial business when you actually aren't. And this is all done and covered and run by the World Science Fiction Society. So I went along to a couple of their business meetings. Again, that's not something your average fan will go along and have a look at because most people think it's about as fun as watching paint dry. But really, it's important that you have to know what's going on. I also, the Worldcon also has to choose the next Worldcon in sequence. Worldcons these days choose the site for the upcoming Worldcon 2 years hence. So this year in 2019, they chose the site for the 2021 Worldcon, and that was chosen as Washington, D.C., pretty much a foregone conclusion, given that they were really the only site that was bidding. I was going to talk about this a bit later, but I can jump in now and talk about it. Next year is New Zealand in Wellington, 2020. That's going to be as close as you can get to Australia without it actually being here. First time it's been in New Zealand, and 10 years since it's been in the Southern Hemisphere when it was here in Melbourne in 2010. So Washington, D.C. has won the right to hold the 2021 convention. Next year, they will be bidding for 2022. And so far, the only site that has put its hand up to be able to run the convention is Chicago. So that's looking like it'll probably be fairly much a foregone conclusion that Chicago will get that. 2023 is a bit different. There are now three sites bidding to be able to hold it. There were four, but New Orleans seems to have dropped out in the last few months. The other three are China for the first time, France also for the first time, and Memphis, again, a city for the first time. It's been in the US many, many times before, so Memphis won't be the first time in that country, but the Worldcon in France or the Worldcon in China will be the first time in either of those two. So it'll be interesting to see how the committees for China and France get their acts together over the next couple of years. Both of them will have to be fairly active next year because they will be bidding in 21 in Washington. And you need to get a bit of a track record behind you where you're showing up at conventions, putting on parties, telling people about what you're aiming to do, what your site's like, what the committee is, and what advice they're getting from other people. So they will, both of those, all three of those will need to be in New Zealand next year. And of course, Chicago will be there because they'll be doing their bidding. Post-2023, in 2024, it's looking likely that Glasgow will be the site. That's the only one currently up there. And 2025, at this stage, Seattle has certainly put its hand up. There was a tentative bid from Perth for 2025, but I'm not sure where that one sits just at this moment. So we'll just have to have that as a watching brief to see whether that comes back online again or whether it's actually going to die. There's been some rumours floating around about what's happening with it, but I'd rather not go into those. I'd prefer that we just follow what the official announcements are from the big committees and then see how that runs from there. So anyway, so all had good time with the bidding in Dublin. And look, and the convention itself was pretty good. First time ever in Ireland, which is always interesting to see how that runs. The major criticism that anybody could have had regarding the convention was that, and you can look at this in either two ways, either there were too many people at the convention or the convention site was too small. Generally, what happens is you don't have much of a choice about what size the convention site is. If you're in a city, you get the biggest one that's there that's available. In America, you can have a lot of different options because the US seems to be the country where they seem to have a convention culture, much more so than anywhere else. And so a lot of the big hotels in the US have large convention facilities. And if you fill up the whole of the hotel, you've got a fairly good chance of being able to get the convention facilities for a much smaller amount of money. So you get a big discount on that. Whereas with places like Melbourne and Dublin, where the convention centre is separated from any specific hotel, you have to rent the facilities. These are very expensive, so you want to make sure that you've got enough people buying memberships to be able to cover the cost of the thing. But then you've also got to be careful that you don't actually go too far and get to the stage where you get far too many people turning up. I think that that's what happened here. I think that Ireland basically allowed the membership to keep on growing when either they could have put a stop to membership sales. They certainly stopped membership sales at the door. Most large Worldcons will sell memberships for the 5 days at the door or will sell day memberships. Now, for those that aren't aware, people will be wondering why I'm talking about these things as being memberships as opposed to tickets. Well, it's a means of being reflective of what the science fiction community wants people to do when they actually join a World Science Fiction Convention. They want you to become a member of the community that's running the convention. They don't want you to be a ticket holder who turns up and say, well, we're here, just entertain us, and then we'll move off and never come back again. They want people to get involved in it. So they want people to come along and help out because it's all volunteer run, these conventions. They want people to help behind the scenes, get to know people. Your membership, if you buy it for the whole 5 days or if you buy it for 1 day, allows you to attend any of the normal convention functions that are on for that particular day. So if, for example, you buy a day membership on the day that the Hugos are being awarded, you can go to the Hugo ceremony and any of the other panels and anything else you can get into. It doesn't mean like a lot of literary conventions where you have to pay $10, $12, $15, $20 or whatever it is for a particular item. You turn up and you find out the person speaking is a total nong, or you don't really want to have anything to do with them, or you just don't like them, or you're bored, you've thrown your $20 away. With a membership, you can just turn up and go and see anything at all, and suddenly you might come across an author and you think, oh, she's pretty good. I must track her stuff down and try and find some. So that's really the reason why it's called a membership as opposed to a ticket.
Mm. And the membership also gives you the right to vote in the Hugos too. That's the other important thing about it.
Yep. So anyway, Dublin basically got to the point where earlier on this year, I think they realised they were going to have too many members and too many warm bodies on deck for the size of the convention centre. So they pretty much decided that the best thing to do was to get some extra facilities. These, unfortunately, were one tram stop away, so they're a bit far away down the river. 8 to 10 minutes walk, which wasn't so bad, but basically people have a tendency to stay in the one place. They don't really want to walk 8 or 10 minutes to go down and go, oh, nothing here, or 8 to 10 minutes, I'll walk back again. You've lost half an hour or an hour just getting to and from. So the major thing with not having enough space really meant that what it came to was that if you were a member of the convention, in general, in my view, you should be able to get to all those big ticket items. You should have an auditorium in the convention centre that's big enough for all the members to attend. So that if you've got 5,600 people attending that you assume are going to be attending, you should have an auditorium that can take 5,600. In fact, probably 6,000 would be good just to give yourself a bit of extra leeway so that you don't have to turn anybody away from the big marquee items, namely the Masquerade and the Hugo Awards. As it happened this year, they had to ask everybody to queue up to get a wristband to be able to attend the Hugo Awards, which put a bit of a dampener on things, I think. And it really, I think they scrambled at the last minute to try and figure out a way of filling up the Hugo Awards, and also giving as many people as possible the opportunity to go. I'm not terribly sure I agree with the way they did it, but hey, I don't necessarily always go to the Hugo Awards. I've been a few times, but I don't go all the time. So that didn't particularly bother me. It bothered some other people that I spoke to, but I can certainly understand the reasons why they would take the decisions they did. You have to remember again that nobody that's running any of these things is a professional, that they are all working as volunteers. And some of these conventions are really, really big. And you have to make difficult decisions that sometimes people are just not going to like. But that happens. Same thing happened in Helsinki. They basically had to, well, they were lucky enough in that the convention centre they had was big enough for them to be able to hire extra space, and they built some extra rooms and put people into those. So that worked out okay. But there was a lot of queuing in Helsinki, and there was a lot of queuing in Dublin, to the extent that after the first day, they had to set up an airport style queuing arrangement because you had the situation of people filling up corridors as they were leaving the rooms, and people trying to get into the rooms couldn't get in, so there was a massive traffic jam. So they decided the best thing to do was to finish the panels 5 or 10 minutes earlier than the hour, clear out the room completely, and then allow the next batch of people to go in, which meant that you couldn't basically sit in a room and just sit there all afternoon and stay in the one place. They asked people to leave and then for a new batch of people to come in. Overall, the convention I thought was pretty good. I would say that it was a success. There was a few minor problems, as I pointed out, in terms of the people. Things ran pretty well. I didn't see any major problems happening. I don't go looking for them. I can see them easy enough if I just look around, and I didn't see any of the easy ones. So if there were any problems, they were the hard ones sitting down underneath in the back office, and it all worked pretty well. So I think
Terrific.
the Dublin committee can be very quite proud about what they did.
Well, that sounds great, Perry. Even though it was crowded, it sounds like it was a pretty good event. So I'm glad you enjoyed that. Now, do you want to spend a bit of time talking now, talking about things you've been reading, things I've been reading, and some
Yes.
one particular author you want to get stuck into, if I think is the right term. So we'll see how we go.
Connie Willis, Oxford Time Travel Series.
Yeah.
This is a set of three, four books. I'll explain why I'm a little bit dubious about whether it's three or four in just a minute. The first one, Doomsday Book, came out in 1992. It won the Hugo, the Nebula, and the Locust SF Award. Second one, to say nothing of the dog, came out in 1998. It won the Hugo and Locust SF Award and was a nominee for the Nebula. And the last one, which is the one that causes me the difficulty because it's really one book split into two volumes,
Yeah, so big.
probably pretty much because of the publisher, I think. Blackout and All Clear, which came out in 2010. And that won the Hugo, the Nebula, and the Locust SF Award. Now, I would reckon that pretty much makes this series of, are we going to call it three or four books?
Let's call it three. I
All
think
right,
let's
okay,
call it
call it
three.
three. That, if you take that as a trilogy, that's probably the most awarded trilogy ever in the field. Now, I know that N.K. Jemisin's Broken Earth series that came out just recently won three Hugos in a row. it picked up another couple of awards, but I don't think it won as many Locus Awards or Nebula Awards as this one did. So in essence, this is, you know, probably up there with the most awarded in the field.
And that begs the question, why? A couple of them are good. The first one was good, but it went downhill from there, don't you think?
I certainly did. I quite enjoyed the first one, Doomsday Book. I thought that was really quite excellent. Now, for people that don't know terribly much about this, it's a series of three interconnected books. I'm referring to them as the Oxford Time Travel Series. I don't know whether it's actually got a specific name. I've looked around for it, but I don't think Willis has called it anything in particular. But anyway, that'll do. It starts off with a group of researchers in Oxford in the UK in the period 2050 to 2060 who have developed the concept of time travel. What they want to be able to do is to put people back into various places in history to be able to observe, what happened, and to gain a lot of insight into the events that happened there, so that they can understand what happened in history.
So they're basically historians and academics, aren't they? That's important, I think, to know. They're not scientists so much as historians and academics.
Yes, they are, and I think that may be part of the reason why I have difficulty with it later on, which I'll get to in just in a tick. The first one, the Doomsday Book, they send a young woman back to Oxford in 1320 to basically have an eyewitness view of how the plague impacts the area around Oxford. As it happens in Oxford 2050, there's also an influenza epidemic, which is basically rampaging through the city. And some people are basically saying that the flu may have been transmitted back through the time machine apparatus, but that's obviously not really what happened. It's just one of those things that crops up. There's been a flu epidemic. But so there's a nice interplay between the two of those things that are going on with that. And it works really quite well, because while there are two streams of maybe two or three streams of the narrative, you don't lose track of where things are and what's going on with it. You've got a good view of what's trying to be done, and the woman ends up being stuck back in Oxford in 1320 for quite some extended period of time. There's some excellent work that was done by the writer in terms of her research, which seems to me to have a lighter touch in the first book than it does in the latter ones. And the latter ones, it sort of basically laid on with a bit of a trowel, I think.
Yes.
And so I think in the last one, and it actually gets down to the stage where it's a shovel, and it gets to the point where it's just overpowering. But the first one I thought was quite good. I thought it was excellent. What was your view of it?
Oh, yeah, I enjoyed the first one too, because expand on the plot a little bit, the young woman they send back gets stranded there mainly because of the problems that are happening at the Oxford end in modern day. And so she's actually stuck there in the past and comes down with the plague. And she's really in a great state as to whether she will actually ever get back to her own time, or whether she'll die there or get stuck there forever. So that's pretty interesting. So it's an interesting concept, I think, and that it worked very well in that first book. The reason I was emphasising the business about the academics and historians is that this is set in Oxford University in the future, but it really almost feels like a future version of a kind of 1930s Oxford, don't you think? It's sort of a very kind of stilted view of what Oxford University life might be like, which is set back almost in the times when Dorothy Sayers was there, you know, that sort of 1920s, 1930s. It just has that feel about it, which is okay as a concept, I suppose. You can take a slightly archaic period and put it into the future and use it that way. But it was a bit odd, I thought. I think we agree anyway. The Doomsday Book was a very good book. It was deserving of the awards. It was an interesting plot, and it kept you stuck. But then we go on to the second book.
Well, just before we get off the Doomsday Book, there's one thing that I started to notice in that book, and then it started to be a bit more, becoming a bit more prevalent as we went along with the second and third books, until we got to the stage where we got to the last one, and I just felt I was getting beaten over the head with it. The major plot problem, well, the major problem with action, I'm not sure, you're a novelist, you'll basically know what the term for this is, but the things that cause those pieces of dramatic tension where there's a lack of communication. Somebody doesn't say what they should have said. Somebody gets interrupted. Somebody butts in and yes. The whole of the something isn't actually said. That happens so often throughout these books. And you get to the stage where you just want to punch somebody, tell them to shut up and let this person just basically say what they were going to say. And she actually gets to the point later on where more than once somebody is about to say something really, really important to another character, and then a fourth or fifth character does something over there in the distance and interrupts the flow, and then the whole of the narrative flow goes over to that particular person, and so what was going to be said was lost.
Yeah.
The first book and the other ones, there's a lack of communication, especially in the first one, where they continually can't find anybody.
Yes,
they're trying
yes.
to get a message to somebody.
Yep.
And I keep thinking, this is 2050. I know that when Willis was writing this in the late 90s, that there wasn't the use of mass instant communication with mobile phones that we have now, but I had a phone in the late 90s, and I had been very late in picking up a mobile phone. I didn't get one. Sure, they weren't the all singing, all dancing ones that you've got now, with where you can access the internet. They were just purely there for SMS messages and for telephone calls. But at least you could actually ring somebody.
Yeah.
And I remember being living in London in the early 90s, and I bought myself an answering machine. Connie Willis does not seem to have ever heard of the concept of an answering machine.
Yeah.
And you sort of get to the point where you think, gah, there's these messages floating around, not being taken, not put anywhere. Yeah. Nobody knows what's going on. And that is the same sort of thing that follows throughout the whole of the three books.
You're absolutely right. And the other thing which follows through, which I was going to say, which is almost along the same lines, is this business of running around trying to find people. And locate them. And in all of her books, including a couple of the other non-Oxford books, there's a whole sequence of passages where people are just running around, trying to also from different places, trying to find people or trying to do something. And it's just they're not sort of able to sort of stay in one spot and sort something out. They're just running through corridors and up and down stairs. And it actually happens in a lot of her books.
This is very much a technique that I seem to recall from some of those romantic comedies from the 1600s,
yes.
School for Scandal and things like that.
It's very much
people
like
jumping
that.
People jumping in and out of cupboards, standing behind doors, not having communication, you know, losing messages and stuff like this. And so you sort of think that she's picked up this technique from those particular books, and really, greats after a while. The first book was fine. I sort of thought, yeah, okay, that's all right. But to keep on using the same technique over and over again sort of gets you down a bit. But anyway, moving on to the second book.
Yes.
To Say Nothing of the Dog. You probably like this one better than I do.
No.
I don't like it at all.
No. It she tries to be funny, and she tries to base it on Jerome K. Jerome's Three Men in a Boat, which has the subtitle To Say Nothing of the Dog. So Three Men in a Boat, To Say Nothing of the Dog. So that the whole joke hangs off this Jerome K. Jerome concept of the three men sailing down the Thames River, rowing down the Thames River. And then she ties a whole bunch of other things to it. Do you remember the subtitle to this novel?
No.
It's To Say Nothing of the Dog, or How We Found the Bishop's Bird Stump at Last.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And that's an object. What was it Hitchcock called it?
MacGuffin.
MacGuffin. The MacGuffin is this pedestal or something that they're trying to rescue from the Coventry Cathedral before it gets bombed during the Second World War. They're trying to retrieve this thing for some reason. I now can't remember why, but they're trying to retrieve it. And it's, as you say, it's very much like a French farce. There's all these people running around in different directions, except there's time travel involved in it. So no, I didn't like the second book at all. I thought that was really poor. I didn't mind the third and fourth books, or the third book, whatever you like to call it.
I tried to read. I recall trying to read Three Men in a Boat probably 20, 30 years ago, and didn't find it at all funny. I
Oh,
found it
really?
just I just
Oh,
found it tedious.
it's so funny.
Now we have discussed this previously, that books that you read 30 odd years ago, that you thought were, oh God, I don't like this. Sometimes if you go back and reread them again later on, or give them another shot later on,
Yeah.
they can actually, they open up to you for whatever reason. It's because your level of maturity, or you're looking at it from a different perspective. And it's certainly worth my while. It will be worth my while to go back and have a look at that book again, just to see whether there really is something there that everybody says something about. But 30 odd years ago,
No?
no,
Oh, well, never mind.
couldn't
I
finish
think
it. Could
certainly
not finish
I
it.
think it's one of the funniest books ever written. But
Ah, well,
there
there
you
you go.
go.
See,
There you go.
well, see, I trust your intuition in books. I'm quite happy to go back and do it. To go back and look at it again. Just got to find the time and try to work out where I can sneak it into the schedule.
But I think anyway, we agree anyway that the second of Connie Willis's Oxford books is really not that good. Because
No,
if
it's not.
she tries to be funny and she doesn't make it.
Yep. And then we come to the last one, Blackout and All Clear. Originally envisaged as one particular novel, and then got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, to the extent that I believe the publisher just said, look, we can't publish it that size, because it ends up combined weight of about 1,000 pages.
That's right.
Now this is a brick of a book if it came out in one volume, as it is in two volumes. I can only heartily recommend that if people were going to do read this book, that they read it one after another. I read the first one and thought, I need a break from this. Left it for a few months, then came back to it and read it again just recently, and I'd lost the thread. Slowly started to pick it up again, but again it was the same thing about lost communication. And I kept on thinking all the time when I'm going through this. Now, if I was running this as a project in a business, what would I basically do? And believe it or not, I actually came back to the thought of Apollo 11. And you might say, well, how the hell does that fit in with the time travel? But what it comes down to is, if you think of the Apollo 11 mission, they had two blokes, well, they sent three men to the moon. Two left the command module in the Lunar Explorer in the LEM and went down to the surface. One stayed up in the command module there the whole way. So he was there as the communications conduit, if required, between the men on the moon and the ground. But he was also there to ensure that when the men got off the moon, that there was somebody at both ends of the connection for them to join up properly. This does not seem to be a concept that Willis is aware of. I've also was thinking about spy novels that I've read. And a lot of those, what they end up doing is they will, and in particular, and I must talk to you about these at some stage, the Adam Hall Quiller novels, where Quiller is a lone operative. He's basically pitched into a theatre of conflict somewhere, trying to get either a person or some information out of a particular dangerous situation and get that information or the person out of the country and back over to the West. And what they do there is that they have a field controller who goes in and sits in a safe house, and he is the one that basically runs all of the communication and looks after everything and plans it all. The operative, namely in this case Quiller, goes in and does whatever he needs to do, gets all the information, and gets back in contact with the control whenever he needs to. They don't seem to do this
No,
in this arrangement.
no,
They
no.
have not set up a particular person who never leaves the village or the town where they originally slotted into, so you know exactly where the hell this person is. They seem to wander around for 1,000 pages looking for each other.
Yeah, exactly. It's
And
a whole meme, isn't it? Of wandering around looking for each other. It goes throughout all these books.
it does get to the point where, as I said earlier, you really want to get to the point where you want to slap somebody or just punch them in the face and say, can you just plan this better? Can you just figure this out? This is not all that hard. You just be in the one place and you know where to go to.
Yep.
So anyway, there's some interesting things that Willis talks about with time travel, in the sense that there are particular events in time, in the timeline, that are major events. In this case, Dunkirk, Battle of Britain, D-Day, those sorts of things, which are sort of like inviolate, that you can't actually get to those particular points very easily, that you have to sort of sneak up on them by going in early and then staying and then joining and then becoming part of the event in order for you to be able to be there. So you've got to go in early and just become part of the whole culture and the milieu of what's happening, so that you can actually observe the event. So that's interesting. And of course, some of the things they do, some of the things that the operatives, the historians back in 1940s Britain at this point, are impacting different people and different events, and they become seriously worried that what they've done is that they may well have lost the war, and then realize later on, well, hang on, maybe what we've done is actually helped the war. So you don't really know that as to whether the time travel component was inherent in the Allies winning the first, Second World War or not losing it. So, you know, it gets a little
That's kind
bit,
of nice.
it gets a little bit timey-wimey, as Doctor Who used to say. But look, it's very interesting. It's I could safely go back and reread the first book at some time, maybe in 10 years, but I don't think I'll be touching the others.
No, I couldn't imagine it.
Life's too short.
It's too short.
Well, look, I'm
Have you read any of her other books or?
no, I've no, I haven't actually. Oh, these are really the only ones that I've ever come across that I've read. So, because I know that you're a bit of a fan of her shorter fiction, aren't you?
Well, only to the extent that I read one short story collection, which is called Firewatch, which I enjoyed the stories in. And there's a couple of stories in there which are really very interesting. One's called Service for the Burial of the Dead, which is a really interesting ghost story. And there's another one which is a story I would hate to have to read again. If you said, David, here's $20. $25. Go and read the story again. It's called All My Darling Daughters. I would say, no, keep your money, because it actually
Okay.
it's so creepy. It's
Oh,
interesting.
okay.
It's interesting in that it's tied. She does tie things up with interesting literary things. It's actually tied up with Elizabeth Barrett, who became Elizabeth Barrett Browning, and she elopes with R Robert Browning. And her father, who was obviously a clearly abusive father, has her pet dog killed because his daughter's left with this guy. But it's quite clear in retrospect that he was a sexually abusive father too. But this story is set in the future on some in some futuristic college somewhere, and they're on some other planet, and they how can I cover it? There's a means of sexual gratification developed by the male members of the college, which involves alien creatures, and it makes you feel sick to the stomach, quite honestly. But that's what she's trying to do. She's trying to make you feel, oh my God, this, you know, how could anybody be this way? But it all ties up with this business about the sexually abusive father. You know, it's very cleverly done, but I would hate to have to read it again. So
Yeah,
that's
well,
interesting.
there's a couple of books that I can think of, one which we might talk about in a little minute, but there are some that I basically would really struggle to go back and reread now that I've had had children. Ian McEwan's Child in Time is one of those, where I'm not sure if you know of the story. It's been made into a film as well, I believe. That basically, I think it's the father takes child to the supermarket and leaves the child outside the front door, goes into the supermarket, comes back out, and the child's gone. It's in a the child was in a pusher, in a stroller, very young, less than a year old, comes back out, the child's gone. And then it's just the anguish of him having to try and find the child, having to explain that he wasn't involved in the disappearance, that it was, you know, he just left the child there because he thought that the child would be able to get some air rather than being in the supermarket, came back out, and the child's disappeared. And the child is never found. and you never know what happened to it. And it's just the disintegration of the man and his marriage. And I basically, it was so well done and so basic, so harrowing, I couldn't go back and read that.
I'm sure.
Again. Now, I just couldn't touch it. I may be able to when my children have finally left home and gone off and done something else, but once you've had a child, I don't think there are some things. I don't know how the hell he wrote it. I really don't.
Yeah.
You know, that's just really. Anyway, and this sounds like that was a bit like that.
There it's just that, a short story, but yeah, it's makes you shiver.
Creepy.
Yeah, creepy. Yeah. I just before we finish with Connie Willis, though, if I could just mention some of her other books, which are worth reading, I think. These are the non-Oxford books. The first one is one called Lincoln's Dreams, which is a complete misnomer because it's really Robert E. Lee's dreams rather than Lincoln's dreams. But it's an interesting story set in the present day about a woman who is actually reliving or having Robert E. Lee's dreams herself. It's as though she's experiencing what Robert E. Lee is thinking and dreaming about back in the Civil War. It's very interesting. It's very hard to explain the concept briefly, but I thought that was very interesting. The other one that's worth mentioning is a book called Passage, which is all about near-death experiences and people researching near-death experiences. And there's a fair bit in there where the people are running around looking for each other, as in all of her books. Anyway, Passage is really quite clever. And one of these researchers eventually undergoes a near-death experience herself. There's some mechanism where she can be put in the same state as a near-death experience happens. And she finds herself in this long white passage, like all these people do who have near-death experiences. But she manages to pursue this experience and pursue it and pursue it and pursue it. And she goes further and further and further and further down this passage. And then she finds herself out in the corridor of the SS Titanic before it strikes the iceberg. It sounds ridiculous, but it's actually a very, very interesting. The book's all about death and experiences of death and so on. It's actually quite clever. So that is worth mentioning, I think. So that's probably enough. We've probably talked ourselves to death about Connie Willis, but she's an interesting writer. But she does have some annoying tropes, that, like this running around everywhere, which is certainly what happens in Passage too.
Yeah, well, that was pretty off-putting for me. So I'll take it under advisement that I'll go and read some more of Willis's work at some point down the track.
We'll try Passage. You'll find it interesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We'll give that a try. So, David, above and beyond the other stuff that we've talked about today, what have you been reading that is of interest?
Well, a couple of books, not science fiction. I could talk about some science fiction or fantasy books I've been reading, but it'd probably be better to keep those for another occasion. But the best couple of books I've read recently have not been science fiction. One of them is called The Choke by Sophie Laguna. It's an Australian novel set up on the Murray near Echuca, and the Choke itself is where the Murray narrows and comes through a small narrow passage and runs more rapidly. But it's all really about a young girl who it's all written from her point of view, and it takes a while before you realize that she's not quite right. There's something wrong with her. She may be autistic or she's not quite with it. And it's really about her growing up. We're in a pretty poor environment. Her father's off traveling. She's living with her grandfather. Her parents are divorced. Her father is really a very unpleasant character who ends up going to jail. She really grows up into teenage years and undergoes some pretty unpleasant experiences. But it's a very clever book. You really feel for this young woman, even though she, as I say, it's quite clear she's not quite mentally right, and that's part of why you feel for her, I think, because she struggles with life. And I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a really top-notch Australian novel, so that was good. The other book which I read, which I think is probably my best book of the year so far, And that's All the Light We Cannot See by a guy called Anthony Doerr, 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 I think might be how you pronounce it, which is very interesting. It's about the Second World War, or set in the Second World War, or lead up to the Second World War. And it's basically around two characters. One is a young German boy who's an orphan, brought up in a pretty poor environment in an orphanage with his sister. Eventually gets picked up by the Hitler Youth because he's a bit of an electronics genius and he's very good with the radio. And he gets picked up by the Nazis and sent to a special school and sort of trained up to be an operator to try and track down things like radio broadcasts by partisans in Russia and so on. And so that's one character. And the other character is a young blind girl who goes blind at the age of about six, living in Paris. And she's raised by her father. Her mother's died some time before. And they have to flee Paris when the Nazis take over France. And they move, go to a particular township, which then falls under siege by the Allied forces because they're trying to attack this particular coastal township. But it's a beautifully written book. It's just beautiful writing. And the way these two lives intersect in all sorts of different ways, and finally they end up actually, these two people actually end up meeting each other. They do not fall in love and go off and live happily ever after,
Oh, that's good to hear.
which is good to hear, but they do have an interesting interaction, all the way back to the fact that the young boy, when he's growing up, with his attempts at building radios and so on, is listening into some broadcasts about science. In French, which he's been taught in the orphanage, because the lady who runs the orphanage is French, so he understands French, and he's been listening to these broadcasts and learning a lot about science from these broadcasts. And then when he finally meets up with this young girl in this village, which is under siege by the Allied forces and invested by the Nazis. He discovers that her grandfather is the one who has been broadcasting these science messages all the way back many years before. It's a beautifully written book, very clever book, and I liked it a lot. So yeah, that's currently my top book of the year. So how about you? There's at least one book you think that we have in common, but you tell me about your other two couple of books.
Okay, well, the first one I wanted to talk about was the latest novel by Adrian McKinty. I think we have mentioned him previously on this podcast. He's probably best known for his series of six or seven books about Sean Duffy, who's a member of the Royal Ulster Constabulary in the Northern Ireland during the Troubles in the 1980s. Duffy's problem is that the Royal Ulster Constabulary is mainly Anglican English, and he's an Irish Roman Catholic. So basically, everybody hates him, and that's where all the tension comes from. These are excellent books. Won some major awards overseas. Won a couple of Ned Kelly Awards for him, but didn't sell very well. Never got picked up for television or film. And so basically, a couple of years ago, while he was living in Melbourne, because McKinty's originally from Northern Ireland, he and his wife, who's an academic, moved to North America and then found themselves in St Kilda and had been here for about 10 years or so. And he found himself at the end with no money. And he'd pretty much decided to give up writing, which I hadn't heard of, but this has all come out in the last 6 months or so. He decided to pretty much give up writing because he just wasn't making any money out of it, and he couldn't afford the time away from a working job to be able to look after his family. And then somebody from, well, another writer that he knew in the US. Contacted him and asked him when his next book was coming out. And he said, "Well, I'm not doing anything." Oh, okay. That bloke went away, got a hold of his agent, and the agent rang McKinty up in the middle of the night and said, "Well, what have you got? Because I've been reading some of the other stuff and I think it's quite good, but I can't sell Northern Irish police procedurals in the US. What have you got?" So McKinty sort of basically said, "Oh, I've got this story that I've been thinking about," and he outlined it. And the guy said, "Oh, that's good. Write it for me." So McKinty sits down, writes 10,000 words, send it off. The agent almost immediately reads it, gets straight back to him, says, well, I want the rest. Where is it? I can sell this. And McKinty finishes it, and it's been going absolutely gangbusters. It's a book that I found a bit harrowing, and you may as well. It's called The Chain. It's basically a... It tells the story of ordinary people who are put under vast amounts of stress to the extent that they have to do things that they would not normally do in order to keep their families together. The whole concept behind it is that your child is kidnapped, and within a couple of hours of your child being kidnapped, you're contacted by the kidnappers who say you have to kidnap and you have to pay a ransom first off, and you have to kidnap another child. And they give you a few ideas about what how to go about doing this. And so the chain is the chain of kidnappings. One group of ordinary parents has to kidnap another child, whose parents have to kidnap another child, and so on. And it just keeps on rolling all the way through. The people that set the scheme up are keeping close tabs on everybody, so they know what's going on and who's doing what. One of the couple that are running the scheme is very technically savvy and is able to infiltrate people's computers so he can see, keep an eye on what they're doing. The main character, who's the one that starts off, who has to do the kidnapping at the start of the book, gets to the point where she decides that she can't allow this to keep on going. And it's the story of how she actually breaks that chain. It's really quite an excellent book, high tension, told in two halves. The first one is when, which deals completely with the first kidnapping of the, basically the disintegration of this woman from a fine, upstanding person in business to becoming a kidnapper and a criminal who is basically willing to kill somebody else's child with a bullet to the head if their child doesn't come back.
Mm.
So it's quite harrowing. It's in my list of the best thrillers this year. Mm-hmm. It will be, it will do very, very well. It will pick up a number of awards. I believe it's already been picked up for a film because it's really tense. And the first half of the book is told almost in real time. So it's over a period of about 18 hours. So it's going to be perfect for a book or a TV series, and it'll get picked up and do very, very well. And I can hardly recommend that one.
Yeah. Well, that's currently sitting on my to-be-read shelf. I'm looking forward to reading that.
The second book that I wanted to talk about was a book called Embers of War by Gareth Powell. This one, this year's British Science Fiction Association Award for the best novel of 2018. I'd read one other book by Gareth Powell called Akak Macaque, which was really not very good. I just did not like it at all. It won another BSFA award as well, I think, and I think it shared it with Ancillary Justice. And so if you get to the point where somebody's going to basically pick up one of the best books of the last 10 years in the science fiction field and say that Akak Macaque is on the same level, that was a bit strange to me. But anyway, so I picked this up because it won the BSFA award, and I wanted to see whether his work had picked up. And I can basically tell you that, yes, it has. This is quite an excellent space opera. It follows along the traditions of a lot of recent space operas where large, big ships are their own artificial intelligences. The book tells of the time after a very large galactic war in which one particular ship called Trouble Dog has undertaken a vicious war crime under direct instruction from its captain to basically bomb a world and destroy a sentient forest, completely destroy a whole race of beings. After the war is completed, it gets a case of doubtful conscience, decides that it's not going to become a was not going to remain a military ship, and decides to join an organization called the House of Reclamation, which is an ancient order of ships in the galaxy which basically act like the Red Cross for other AI ships. They go to the aid of ships in distress. There's a disputed system between the two enemies that, or combatants that fought the Galactic War, and there's this one particular system that sits between the two of them. Both of them sort of semi-claim it, but they don't want to fight another war over it. But a ship goes missing in that, and so Trouble Dog with a new crew goes to try and find it and find out what happens. And it is pretty good. I really, really enjoyed this. I thought this was an excellent little space opera that has a lot going for it. You can obviously see that it's the start of a new series, so I think it's going to tick along very well. And I would suggest that you give it a go. If you like space opera, this is a good one.
All right.
The last book I wanted to talk about is The Lost Man by Jane Harper. Now, I believe you've read this book as well.
Yeah,
we had
I did.
Bit of a chat about it before we came on here.
Yep.
This has just won the 2019 Ned Kelly Award for Best Crime Novel published in 2018 in Australia. Now, Jane Harper burst onto the scene a couple of years ago with a big book called The Dry, which was really quite excellent. Followed it up a little bit too quickly with a book afterwards called Force of Nature, which wasn't as good. Classic sort of second novel problem. But she's gone back and away from the main character that she had in those two books and has a new concept set in a station out in... I was trying to work out where it was, and I think it might be somewhere around the border of South Australia and Queensland. You know that?
Yeah, I thought it was Northern New South Wales.
Southern Queensland, but very, Northern
very
South
hot,
Australia.
Very dry.
Very hot, And the whole thing revolves around the fact that a man is found out in the bush. Well, it's hardly the bush because there aren't any bushes around, but he's basically been found dead, leaning up against the gravestone that's out in the middle of nowhere. And the reason why you find out that he got himself to that particular gravestone was that it was the only piece of shade that he could find anywhere. And the markings on the ground show that he was scrambling around trying to keep the sun behind him because that was the only shade he had. And he was just hoping that somebody would turn up and find him, because he was too far away to go anywhere. And if he started to walk, he was going to die. But this was the one chance he had, but he didn't make it. Now, he's one of three brothers. I think it's three brothers.
Yep.
Who are originally living on a particular station not far from here. One of the brothers has been ostracized because he did at one point something that he should never have ever done. That is, drove past somebody out there on the road whose car had broken down. It was his father-in-law who'd basically been abusing him only about half an hour before, and he was still angry when he drove past him and just left him there, and the father-in-law almost died. And so the whole of the society in that area just ostracizes him. And it's the story of the man that died and the brothers and the relationships between the family, the mother, the father, and everybody else around the place. And I thought it was pretty good. I thought it was handled very, very well. The interesting thing is it's called The Lost Man, but as I was reading it, I was thinking every single bloke here is lost. You could really call this The Lost Men.
That's true.
Because there's not a single one of them that is really on top of himself. The women are strong. The men are attempting to be strong, but basically are weak for a number of different reasons, but mostly because they are attempting to be something that they just can't possibly be and trying to live up to an ordeal they can't make. Everybody suffers the consequences around them.
Yep.
Excellent book,
yeah.
Though.
Yeah, look, I thought the characterization was terrific, and the as you say, the family relationships and the... that side of the book was really very well done and great. I originally gave it 5 stars on Goodreads, and then I slept on it. My problem with Goodreads is sometimes that I put the star down, I put a star rating down the moment I finished a book, and I shouldn't do that, because you do need time to digest a book. And I started thinking about it, thinking about the end of this book, And I can't talk about it without giving away spoilers. So if you want to read the book and you haven't read the book, this is probably a time to turn off the podcast. But there's two things which bother me about it. Firstly, there's this bloody headstone in the middle of bloody nowhere. Why? Nobody puts up a headstone, takes this great big slab of stone and buries it and sticks it in the desert for no reason whatsoever. So that
There's a guy. There's supposedly a guy buried
yeah,
under.
there is, but who the hell would go to the trouble of getting a headstone done and establishing the spot? Anyway, so the concept is that this is the only patch of shade for miles and miles and miles and miles,
Yeah.
and the concept is that he's been out in this lone, this bare area, and he's been unable to walk out. It's too so hot, and there's so much sun that it would be impossible for him to walk out from this spot. Yep, that's the concept.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Now, when we get to the end of the book, however, and we find out the reveal of who actually done it, this person who done it, because it is turns does turn out to be a murder, the person who's done it gets there on a horse, apparently in quite a relaxed sort of ambling sort of journey there. She manages to reach this headstone without dying of heat or heat prostration, or the horse dying of heat prostration. She then gallops the horse away, behind pulling it behind a car, or at least a fast trot, and gets to safety. Now, if a human being can't walk out of that spot to reach safety from there on foot, and a horse can run and not die in the same conditions, no, I just can't cope with that. That just doesn't work for me.
Something didn't gel
It
properly
doesn't
for you.
gel, no. But which is a pity, because, as you say, the actual story and the relationships, it's well worth the awards for that. But just in terms of plot device, I can't take it.
Oh,
So
okay. All
I
right.
went back and made it a 4-star rather than 5-star.
Well, I certainly gave it a five. I thought that, I thought it was worth a five. I gave the chain five
Yeah, I'm
stars.
looking forward to that.
I would have given Embers of War 4.5, but you can't give four and a
No.
half. You either get a 4.5, you either give it 4 or 5 on Goodreads. So I gave it 4, but I really wanted to give it four and a
Yeah,
half.
that's it's the case.
So, but no, I think the chain and the Lost Man will probably end up being in my top five of the year
Sure.
in their particular categories without too much
Yeah,
trouble.
yeah.
So, couple of quite good books.
All right, well,
So I think that's about
yeah, I
it.
think we should probably wind up there. Thanks for that. I'm glad we have you back safely, and we look forward to our next episode.
All right. Thank you, David. We shall talk to you again in a couple of weeks.
Indeed. Cheers.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.